Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 21st, 2000. In the fireside room this morning, we have Dan Mishkin and Karen Ogle. Today's session number is MODK 2005, and is titled Jewish and Christian Connections, Roots, Ritual, and Identity, Shabbat, the Meaning of Rest. Let's listen in.
And this is Friday, and Shabbat starts tonight for Jewish people. So we'll
discuss the Sabbath as it exists in all our lives, with some similarities and some differences, but maybe give you a taste of the Jewish idea of the Sabbath before we talk together about what do we do about the Sabbath. And we wanted to begin with a Midrash. Midrash is an ancient, ancient Jewish storytelling, text enlightening technique. If you read the Bible, you'll find lots and lots of gaps, you know, that you can throw whole movies in, like the recent Prince of Egypt. I teach the book of Exodus to fifth graders at our synagogue, and I find now that they know the story of Moses' childhood, which is fascinating because there's nothing in the Hebrew Bible about Moses' childhood. Just a tiny slice of babyhood, and then he's an adult. But they seem to feel they know it. So what the rabbis have done for many, many years, and in fact, the book that I read this morning at Matins is really an example of that in a way, of coming to an understanding of what God's name is and what we mean when we call to God. The rabbis would tell stories that would enlighten, would add to the text, would amplify, would teach lessons, express a particular point of view, try to find an argument to support their particular case about how Jewish law ought to be interpreted. We have a book by Rabbi Mark Gelman called Does God Have a Big Toe? Which is a book of Midrashim, would be the plural, for children. And we wanted to start out with one that says a little bit about the Sabbath.
This one's called No Lists on the Sabbath. I know you wish you could have lived in the Garden of Eden. I know, great weather, no problems, good food, and water that doesn't taste funny. But believe me when I tell you, the Garden of Eden was no piece of cake, because Adam lived there, and Adam was a list maker. In fact, Adam was the worst list maker of all time. The elephant woke up one morning to find his trunk stuck through a large leaf on which Adam had written in berry ink, "Elephant list for today. 1. Dump all the broken branches outside the garden. 2. Hose down the dirty dishes. 3. Squash some coconuts for lunch." The monkey woke up one morning to find a banana peel tied around its tail, on which Adam had written, in berry ink, "Monkey list for today. Dump rotten fruit outside the garden. 2. Pick bananas for supper. 3. Don't eat the bananas you pick for supper." Come morning, almost every animal woke up with a list, and all day long, Adam would scurry around, checking up on the animals and pestering them to see how they were coming with their lists. One day, the animals got together and said to God, "This guy is such a pest. Can't you move us out of here? Or better yet, can't you move him out of here?" God said, "Wait for the Sabbath. There are no lists on the Sabbath." Mm-hmm. On the morning of the seventh day, Adam woke up bright and early to make his list. He went to get his berry ink pot to write out a list for the elephant, but the ink was dry. "No problem," said Adam. "I'll just go out and pick some more berries for the inkwell." But when Adam got to the berry patch, all the berries were gone. "I bet this is the work of that monkey," Adam complained. "But not to worry, I'll scratch out my lists for all the animals in the sand on the beach." Adam took a stick and started writing lists in the wet sand. But a wave came along and erased all the lists. And Adam thought this was very strange because the Garden of Eden was near a river. And he had never seen a wave that big in the river. So Adam sat down to rest. And he felt good just resting. Then the monkey came by. No lists on the Sabbath, he chirped. The elephant came by and trumpeted, no lists on the Sabbath. And all the animals wished Adam a good day of rest.
One of the things that I find striking about this story is that it's not only the animals that are liberated from Adam's list making. They, of course, have this wonderful day of rest, but they're wanting it, you know, they're ready for it. Adam needs to be taught, and if we were going to add our own little midrash to the end of this one, we would say, and Adam finally realized the beauty and the glory and the liberating power of ceasing to make lists and ceasing to think in terms of what have I got to do next. Mm-hmm. And that is really something I think as modern people we sometimes need to be taught, and which I think the Shabbat teaches us. I wanted to take a minute to just talk about the Hebrew word, just for those of you who are interested in this sort of thing, that the Hebrew word Shabbat, and you can see, of course, because Hebrew goes the opposite direction from English in writing, so we've tried to make it clear. Those three letters, Shin, Bet, Tav, that make the word Shabbat, also have other meanings from that rune. Sheva, the B and the V are sometimes the same letter. Sheva means seven. The verb means rest or sit or cease. You may have heard of the time of mourning after the death in a Jewish household called Shiva. And that comes also from the same word, which means to sit. Traditionally, we sit on low stools as we mourn. And it has all those meanings. And sometimes you need to be careful in the reading of the Hebrew to make sure you're getting the right one. But there's that interrelatedness of resting and sitting and stopping and seven and Sabbath.
It's the same verb that's used to describe what God did on the seventh day, usually translated as ceased. So, you know, it's another same root.
So, where does this Shabbat come from? We know that the idea of Shabbat seems to come out of the story of creation, with God ceasing on the seventh day, pausing, resting. And we know about the Ten Commandments, right? Actually, before we get to the Ten Commandments, we have the story of the newly liberated Israelites who are in the desert and are, as the Israelites are going to do for the next 40 years, grumbling. And Moses tells them not to worry about food, that each day they will find this substance called manna. And the manna will be there for them every day. They should take what they need and not take too much because it will not be there the next day. It will rot. But on the sixth day, Moses says, take two portions of manna, and this time it will not rot. The second amount will be available for you tomorrow. And that's sort of the first reference to the human experience of Shabbat. One of the interesting things about that is that it says, after this whole situation is described, it says, you see that the Eternal has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. You see that he has given you the Sabbath. Not that he's giving it to you now. The assumption, as the rabbis read this text, was that the Sabbath has always been there. You know, this is not a new invention. The Sabbath really precedes our existence. And so although there will be a discovery of it and laws and regulations about it, the Sabbath is a sort of eternal creation that exists outside of our existence. And then we get to the text that you're more familiar with from the Ten Commandments. There's also, as many of you probably know, a repetition of the Ten Commandments roughly in Deuteronomy. Two words used about the Sabbath observance. One is the word zachor, which means remember, and one is the word shomer, which means, variously translated, observe, keep, or guard. Now, remembering seems a little weaker. It's the one that's referred to in the Exodus text. Although, you should keep in mind that the word remember, when it's used in the Hebrew Bible, has a connotation of action. I think I mentioned the other day in one of our sessions, that when God remembers Sarah, or remembers one of the other matriarchs, it's a sign that that remembrance is going to lead to action on God's part. When God remembers God's covenant with the Israelites, it's a sign that the liberation, the redemption, is about to begin. So here, if we're called upon to remember, well, we're called upon not to act, of course, on the Sabbath, but maybe we're called upon for a conscientious inaction as a result of our remembering. So we've rearranged a little. We are always rearranging our lesson plans, depending on what happened the previous day. So I've got to skip down to notes. And there's one other reference in here in Exodus 31, which says that Israel's descendants will keep the Sabbath, making it a covenant, an eternal covenant throughout all their generations. And also reminds us that this is because of what God did. Another interesting Hebrew word, and then I'll stop with Hebrew words for a while. It says that God rested, Shavat v'yinafash, which is translated as was refreshed, as sort of took a breath. But nefesh, the word that's in the middle of yinafash, also means soul. So in a way, God restored God's own soul in this process of resting on the seventh day. And in imitation of that, we're meant to do the same thing.
Yeah, I think the one other text reference to Shabbat, and there are lots of them, you know, throughout the Torah, there's a lot of discussion about Shabbat. But the other story, and it's a, you know, it's a disturbing story at a literal level, is about the poor fellow who was gathering some firewood on Shabbat. And, you know, the people find him gathering the firewood, and they're really disturbed. And it's not entirely clear if they're certain that you can't gather firewood. You know, do they have some uncertainty about that, or are they just uncertain about what the punishment should be for doing this on Shabbat? But anyway, for whichever reason that is, they bring him, you know, in front of the whole community, in front of Moses and Aaron, and you know, for this judgment. And then Moses apparently is a little unclear as well about exactly what ought to happen, because he consults with God about what should happen. And God's response, you recall, is kill him. Put him to death for this offense of gathering firewood. And you think about the horrible things that people do throughout the Old Testament. And, you know, some of them get relatively mild punishments, from my point of view anyway, about some of these things. And here, some poor schmuck is just gathering firewood and that's it, you know, it's over. And so, you know, like I said, literal level, it's not a particularly pleasant story, and not one of the more engaging aspects of God. But I think at a, you know, at a more metaphoric level, it's a very powerful statement about how important this is for the Jewish people to observe Shabbat. You know, and how absolutely critical this is. And you know, there are rabbinic commentaries about this that really take it to another level and say that you could look at this as not observing Shabbat, not giving yourself this cycle of rest will shorten your life. You know, that will lead to early death. It's a generous interpretation. But
we're very good at removing these primitive aspects of God whenever possible in interpretation of the stories.
You know, centuries of work, so.
But the Sabbath is this supremely important time. In fact, all other holidays have to be subservient to the Sabbath. So, as happened, I think, 2 out of the last 3 years, either Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year and the time of atonement, fell at least one of the days on the Sabbath, which meant you cannot blow the shofar, which, as we were mentioning the other day, is such an integral part of a Jewish experience of what those holidays are about, the ram's horn being blown and calling us out of the deepest part of ourselves to make changes in our lives. But we may not do it if the holiday falls on Shabbat. Although Yom Kippur is called sort of the Shabbat of Shabbats, it's... The Shabbat practice has to take precedence. It's very important. You were reading something about the comment of what's the first thing that you do if you're going to try to to get back to Jewish practice.
Right.
The very first thing that the commentators will say is keep the Sabbath.
And it's an interesting because you read that no matter what. The whole spectrum of Judaism, the most liberal reform rabbis to the most, we'll skip the adjectives, orthodox, that's still the same answer. What's the most important thing to do for somebody who has not been observing anything about their Jewish faith to start? With one voice, they say, start to observe Shabbat. It's a real striking sense of the importance of it.
So now we're moving a little bit from the biblical idea of Shabbat into the actual Jewish practice of Shabbat and the Jewish understanding of the Shabbat. And of course, there are many, many, many laws that rose up because, like the list maker Adam, Jews are rule makers. It really is central to our understanding of what our relationship with God is, because we have a covenant with God, we have a contract with God, there are responsibilities on both sides. And so the impulse in Jewish tradition has always been to codify what those responsibilities are going to be. Did you have a question?
I was waiting to fly away.
Oh, well, you know. Did the fly have a question? So there are lots of these rules. And this is one more Hebrew word, halacha, which means the way. Those of you who were here on Monday and in our discussion of Abraham and the beginning of the Abraham story, which begins, lech lecha, we go out and go forth. That lach in here is the same thing. It's the path, going out on the path. And so halacha has become the word for that codifying of our understanding of what our responsibilities to God are, what we're commanded to do by God. So there's all of that, all those rules, and you can ask us, you know, outside of a big group, how many of them we actually follow. But of course, that's really the issue, isn't it? You know, how do we follow? Before we get to that, which I think we want to have as a more open discussion of what it means to keep the Sabbath, a little bit about what the Jewish understanding outside of the rulemaking has been. I'm always tempted to ask Dorothy to come up and do the discussion of Rabbi Heschel. Dorothy Bass, who's in the back of the room, has edited the book Practicing Our Faith, which I know has been mentioned and probably signed for some of you this morning. And she has written in that book a wonderful section on the idea of the Sabbath and keeping the Sabbath right there.
Great. Just great.
And in it, I believe that she was influenced in part by Heschel's ideas. Heschel is a rabbi who was born in Poland, became an American citizen, lived from the early 20th century, died in the 1970s, and a really significant, important thinker, philosophizer, person with remarkable insights into Jewish practice and the Jewish understanding of life.
Heschel, I think it's worth mentioning, came out of a Hasidic background, the sort of the Jewish mysticism tradition from Eastern Europe,
right,
which played a really important role in a lot of what he contributed.
And what's interesting about his books, and this particular book that he wrote called The Sabbath, Its Meaning for Modern Man, which is in the Holden Library, is that he's sort of just this side of too mystical for me, thank you very much. You know? So it becomes really useful and helpful to look at without thinking that you're sort of going off into this sort of other world that you can't combine with your real life. Heschel talks about the fact that we live our lives in space, or so we believe. We live our life in the things of space, working on the things of space, what he calls technical civilization. And he tells us that that's really more or less an illusion. The idea that space is what's real and present and solid and eternal, and that time is what runs out constantly, that we don't have enough of, has got it exactly backward. That time is the real. Time is our home. Time is where we live. And Shabbat reminds us of that. And I just want to read a little piece, or if you want to read. Heschel writes, "When gazing at reality, while our souls are carried away by spatial things, time appears to be in constant motion. However, when we learn to understand that it is the spatial things that are constantly running out, we realize that time is that which never expires, that it is the world of space which is rolling through the infinite expanse of time. Time is everlasting. It is the world of space which is perishing." And I think that for those of us who even have a glimmer of a sense of what eternity might mean, that's what Heschel is talking about, that eternity is real. And when we place ourselves in the mindset of eternity, even for this one day a week, in what he calls a palace in time, we establish our link to the real, the eternal that's beyond the things that will fade. And it's a really powerful, powerful image. And it makes you just stop and say, what am I doing with all this running around?
It's an extraordinarily powerful book. I read it for the first time this spring as we were doing some preparing for this. It's one of those things that you cannot understand how it is that you haven't read this book before once you read it. But for anybody that hasn't read it, that's interested in this topic at all, I just can't recommend it strongly enough. It's a quite small book and very easy to enter into, not a complex. You might, if you're talking about him, he's a great philosopher, you might be a little put off about whether you want to read it. But it's just a terrific piece of work.
And very engaging.
Yeah.
And so if you have this sort of new understanding of the world of time, and you let go of some of your ideas, we read in a number of places about the idea that, you know, I'm too important to take one day off a week. Now, we might not say that, but isn't that what we're doing through our actions? Aren't we saying, oh gosh, I just don't know if I've really got the time for that? Well, I think you have to start understanding that you're not that important. And yet, you do have the time. I read just, we didn't have a chance really, either of us, to read this book that Karen found in the Holden Library called Keeping the Sabbath Holy, spelling holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y.
I know many of you are, this is somebody in the congregation of, is it the Vancouver crowd?
Yeah.
That know this woman, Marva Don, but this is a...
I came upon just one little interesting piece about the time of westward expansion, where a group of devout Christians were heading west, and fearful about winter coming on, they wondered if they should keep their practice of stopping for the Sabbath, that one day a week. And they had a discussion, and there were quite a few arguments back and forth, and they decided, well, those who would... who wanted to press ahead would be in one group, the others who were going to keep their Shabbat observance would stay in another group. And it was those who kept the Sabbath who arrived at their destination first. And that's not through any immediate divine intervention, I don't think. It's because the cycle of our lives based on rest as an integral part of our lives will take us farther. Will, as Karen was saying before, extend our lives, because we're not killing ourselves. We're not killing the horses. You're not killing ourselves. And it's really an interesting example of how there's so much that sort of rebounds to our everyday life once we put the Sabbath in our lives. Yeah.
This morning I was reading something that pointed out that the beginning of the Bible says, in the beginning God created, but how so often we have transferred that to say, in the beginning man created, mm-hmm. and it sort of ties into that, because mm-hmm. I got to keep creating. And I gotta mm-hmm. keep visiting.
That's right. And you know, an important, significant Jewish understanding of the Sabbath is that, and that all this halachic rulemaking is about, is that we have to cease altering creation, because we alter creation on the other 6 days, but on that seventh day we must not create, we must not destroy, we must have nothing to do with the ongoing process of creation. And I think it's very much along the lines of what Terry is saying. So I think that the only other thing that I want to point out before we open it up is that this, again, in the Jewish sense, there's this idea of separating the rest time, the sacred from the profane. We do it both at the beginning of the Sabbath, which would be tonight, and we will have one table set in the dining room at the second setting of dinner for those who want to join us for the Hebrew prayers and the welcoming of the Sabbath. And then tomorrow night, for the larger group, as we did last Saturday night, we'll have the Havdalah service, which is the separation of departing from the Sabbath. We mark both the beginning and the end. And we don't demean the rest of the work week, but we do say, let us have this separate, clearly marked space.
In fact, not only don't demean it, in both the welcoming Shabbat, in the extended blessings, not what we'll be doing tonight, but in the full thing and in the full Havdalah service, we thank God for work at both the beginning and the end of Shabbat. So it's not in any way setting itself as superior to the rest of the week.
That's right. Well, it is superior to the rest of the week, but it's
well,
you know,
what I mean.
But it doesn't cause us to renounce the rest of the week, and we should welcome the parts of our lives spent with dealing with creation and changing creation and interacting. Yeah, Dave?
Maybe when it's going to open up, but could you talk a little more about what it is that defines work or defines rest? Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we wanted to all talk about, because I think that's the really interesting part. And at least to me, it's got to be, to a significant extent, a personal definition for it to have meaning as
now,
a day of rest.
And I don't know, Dave, if you're asking about the traditional definitions in Orthodox Judaism.
Yes. I mean, like you were just saying, Dan, one of the elements is you don't do anything that would be interpreted as creating or opportunity to creation. Rightly or wrongly, I don't know, but I've heard it said that one definition of Sabbath in the Jewish community is anything that involves offering sacrifice. I'm starting a fire, those sorts of things. But there must be some different. Not so. Okay. Well.
I haven't heard that.
Yeah. But are there midrash or stories or things that try to prescribe what is within the allowed?
There's volumes of halakha about this. I mean, literally, it's just.
It gets to a point that, you know, I'm going to admit, just strikes me as really going over the edge. But then I wasn't raised in that tradition, and I have to have some respect for those. Those of you who haven't been here remember, will not remember our three B's of religious ways of being religious, believing, behaving, belonging. Behaving is very important in the Jewish understanding and of how we live lives close to God. And so there are those for whom following these rules is about behaving as God commanded, and it's less important to them whether they quote-unquote make sense. But the rules are, of course, lighting fires. Carrying is not allowed. Now, this creates problems for, well, let's say women who have children, which really bugs me about the way we allow everybody to participate in the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. But then they're you know, enormous elaboration.
And you'll recall that the sort of the framework we've laid out for you for understanding the spectrum of American Judaism is that, you know, you've got an Orthodox branch of Judaism that's a pretty small amount of American Judaism. And then you've got this conservative branch that accepts halakha but does still a lot of individualizing of how it's followed. And then you got Reform and Reconstruction who don't regard halakha as binding. So as far as, you know, what are all the technical detailed rules, we're not experts on that. We don't know anybody who is. It's a very small part of the Jewish community that follows Shabbat in that way.
But you will, if you're on your own, pick up a tenet like, it makes sense to me to say we should not be creating or burdening the creation. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I'll define personally for myself how to worship.
Yeah, and it's an ongoing thing. I mean, I don't have this like worked out where I've got perfect Shabbat every week and terrific rest and, you know, set myself free and do all this. No, it doesn't happen. I just keep working at it. You know, kind of a contradiction in terms, but
one example of the sort of modernizing of the traditional rules is a reconstructed understanding about driving on the Sabbath. Of course, the rules were not about cars initially, but you know, it came to pass that when cars were available, it pretty quickly became clear that was going to be considered not okay. We're not working the horses anymore, but we're working, you know, it's some kind of work. Well, a newer way to think about that is in the sort of ecological sense, and to tie creation and what we're supposed to do with creation to the internal combustion engine. And you say, oh, well, look at what we're doing. If we're at all ecologically minded, we are altering creation, and not only altering it, but altering it for the worse when we drive that car to shul, to synagogue, on Shabbat morning. So let's not do that. You know, let me walk or ride my bicycle, and let my breath, my soul, be integral rather than changing God's creation around me.
This is a lot of the kind of the renewal movement and trying to reinterpret in ways that are meaningful for the current world. And to me, that's a lot more meaningful than. Let me give you an example of like in Israel, in high-rise buildings. Many high-rise buildings, they have Shabbat settings for elevators. And so the Shabbat elevator just stops at every floor. So no one has to break Shabbat by the work of pushing the button. Now that, to me, that's just a ridiculous rule. What would really be maybe more meaningful is don't ride the elevator, you know, in terms of this kind of thing. But when I say it's, to me, it's a ridiculous rule, I don't mean it in a disrespectful way for people to whom it is a meaningful rule, but it doesn't work for me.
I do. I mean it in a disrespectful way.
But if you didn't ride the elevator and you had to take the stairs, wouldn't that be worth taking the stairs?
Walking isn't.
Walking isn't work.
Halakhically defined as, yeah.
And riding your bike is work.
Oh, right. Riding your bike, I believe, would not meet halakha. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. We don't have any rabbi who would decide for us that we have contact with. But I would. My personal definition would be that the bike would not be changing creation, and that's enough for me.
Only about it in terms of the driving thing. And again, we can't stress enough. We're talking about. We are not here as halakha experts.
Not by a long shot.
Can you kind of gives an overview of what you do on the Sabbath, like Christians go to church on the Sabbath, one of the things I think of is the Sabbath is a time of rest. Now I go to church, it seems like, well, I'm sure our minister, our pastor, that's his work day, and so I'm wondering, how is he getting his rest? But do you go to synagogue and do you have services and stuff like that?
Well, let's give you an outline of what a classic classic Jewish Shabbat would look like. But again, stressing that we're not trying to pretend here that we're like perfect observers of this everywhere. I mean, we got 3 children that have, that all play soccer, it's all soccer schedule on Saturday mornings. It's a complex thing to put into the modern world. But in theory, what happens and what is really important to most Jewish families is Friday night. Really a critical thing of trying to have a special dinner, a Friday night dinner, to welcome a Shabbat, to be together as a family, even if you can only negotiate a brief togetherness with all the family members, but that's a really important thing. We often try to talk again, briefly, if that's all we can do, about that this week's Torah portion in our family discussions on Friday night, to just talk a little bit about what's this portion, what kind of meaning might it have to us as we move into Shabbat.
And just by the way, one of the great things that the internet has brought is many listservs that have new commentaries on the Torah portion. Right. So I can go before Friday night, I can look at 4 or 5 commentaries on the Torah portion, which the ones I tend to look at will tend to think in modern terms and modern life and provide some lessons. We had a rabbi, a school director at our synagogue, who said that what she liked to do, another Hebrew word, Parshat HaShavua, means the portion of the week. She said that she would put on her Parshat HaShavua eyeglasses at the beginning of the week, and she would try to see her everyday life through the lesson and the meaning of what the weekly portion was going to be about the following Sabbath. So we use the parsha if we can get everybody to sit still. And so
Friday nights are a really important thing for most Jewish families. That's probably the most important part of Shabbat.
And it's the one that fits into
the
rhythm of American life better. A lot better than Saturday morning. Our congregation does not have a Friday night service. The other congregation in our town does, and probably has a pretty big emphasis. That's a Reformed congregation, and that's where I grew up in. When I was a kid, we had the Friday night service, and then our Saturdays really were not very attentive to the Sabbath, unless we had a bar mitzvah to go to.
So as far as the rest of the time, we do try to go to shul on Saturday morning. The great tradition of Shabbat is a nap. That's a really common thing that people really try to take a Shabbat nap. There's the meals of Shabbat, are again in theory, at least in our house, in theory only, prepared ahead of time, so that you have your meal, especially your Saturday evening meal, is already there and stuff. And then Havdalah, comes at the end. to then mark the separation, the end of.
And we also have study too. So give me the sacred fragment to look. Mm-hmm. Our the rabbi for we're in a university town. The rabbi for Hillel, which is the Jewish student college student organization, held a regular, really over the course of several months, discussion group after Saturday morning services. And after we have a little luncheon at the after services, and then Rabbi Phil would hold a discussion on chapters of this book called Sacred Fragments by Rabbi Neil Gilman, another great book. And you know, that's an important part of the Sabbath observance too, is text study or study of anything Jewish related to our Jewish lives. Mm-hmm. Chuck, you had something?
Yeah, and I don't know if this is the appropriate time to raise it, but before we quit this morning, I would like to ask that you address this agenda item. I think for most Christians, the idea of Shabbat is at least partly shaped by the words attributed to Jesus in the Gospels on the Sabbath. And he's often charged, of course, with violating the Sabbath. I guess what I'd like to hear from you is your perception of whether, in fact, what Jesus was doing when he said things like, the Sabbath is made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath, whether he was behaving and speaking in a way that violated, or was he recalling to the true meaning of the Sabbath? And at some point, if you'd be willing to address that,
I'd like to make a couple of historical comments about that. I don't have the answer to the question, and I probably don't expect to ever have it, because I don't expect to be studying Jesus in the depth that you would need to do to answer that question. I think that's more your question to answer. But, you know, the Shabbat was not as regulated at the time of Jesus as it is, you know, in the, all this halakha was not developed. Now that all really happens during the time of rabbinic, the whole rabbinic period.
I think it begins to happen before Jesus, but it's not.
Yeah, but it's not anywhere. I mean, it's all this codification really, yeah. You know, comes in that after the first century, you know.
The destruction of the temple.
Well, that's the point, you know. I wanted to make is that.
And yet, at that time, some considered him to be violated.
Right. But so what you have, though, are really more these basic commandments about Shabbat that are in the Torah. So, you know, I guess that's a, you know, that becomes a, for Christians, that becomes a, what, you know, this issue of what do you do about contradictions in, you know, when God has spoken and then Jesus says something else. And, you know, what, so I don't know. I have no idea what the answers are to that.
Yeah.
But the thing that I have really come to appreciate historically as we've been doing more studying for this is the really incredibly powerful influences on both of these faiths, Christianity and Judaism, of the split between them. And everything that was going on in that timing, the Roman domination, I think a lot of this really shaped a lot of the work of Paul, as I understand it, and the destruction of the temple in, let's just say, 70. I mean, you know, somewhere around 70,
yeah.
The temple is destroyed for the final, you know, the second destruction. And so that Judaism is transformed, really, and then, you know, that the destruction occurs because of this Roman crackdown. So that there's this whole, the diaspora begins, the rabbinic period begins as these little enclaves of scholarly activity start up. And many scholars talk about the halakha becoming a replacement for the temple. So that building a structure of law that will replace the structure of the temple. And it's a, you know, it's a helpful way to understand why a people would go off into what can seem like, you know, absurd levels of rulemaking. And then to see Christianity and Judaism maybe having started out really not that far apart on some of these issues, but in reaction to each other, becoming much farther on the other sides. And that's been very helpful to me as a model. So just for what that's worth, it's a...
The only other comment I have a bit about the, you know, how to judge Jesus' actions in Jewish terms really ties in with something that I said in response to one of Gladys's sessions the other morning. I read some of the complaints about Jesus' actions as using the law as a way of dealing with a political problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they say, oh no, you're violating the law, Jesus. Well, what that really seemed to me to be about as a new reader of this material is, let's see, I gotta find some reason to get this guy, to put this guy in his place.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that that's part of what's going on, because after all, you know, there's, even in the halacha, there's vast exceptions written into Sabbath.
Yeah, in fact, I was just to one more thing about that is, in terms of the Sabbath sister, who's unnamed, correct? She doesn't have a name. Okay, so the woman who's healed though from being bent over for I forget how long, a heck of a long time, you know. Now, that's just clearly wrong. I mean, the interpretation that he shouldn't do that on Shabbat, that's clearly wrong. So that's a branch of the law that, you know, being a doctor, I've looked into. You know, it's like, what really is the violation? And it's just, I mean, it's just crystal clear, even in halacha, that if you can do anything to help somebody else with a sickness, and it doesn't have to be life-threatening, if you can do that on Shabbat, you should.
So healing on the Sabbath is not a violation?
Not, absolutely not.
Right.
Now, I think that story could be interpreted, and I don't know what all the layers of scholarship in that area are, but to me, that story could be interpreted as critiquing him to be healed. But that woman didn't come looking to be healed, right, as I recall. I mean, you could interpret whatever that guy was saying as critiquing the crowd, not critiquing Jesus.
And the other thing I think that you could do is you could put yourself in the place of the synagogue leader and say, you know, he could have done this yesterday. And he's really sticking it in my face.
There's an aspect of that.
Yeah. So, you know, but again, we're talking about a political situation. I mean,
which I think is the most helpful way to look at it. But.
But there are all these, you know, exceptions of life-saving and healing of you know, the more mundane sort are certainly well within the purview of the exceptions to work during the Sabbath.
There's an interesting book called A Rabbi Talks to Jesus that addresses some of these issues. You know, I mean, I don't think it addresses the healing, because I think that one's very clear that that's okay, that it's not an issue. But it does, it's like a rabbi, it's written by a rabbi, and it's set up as, you know, sort of structured as arguing with Jesus on some points of theology.
Right.
And so it's a very interesting book to look in, you know, look at some of these kinds of questions.
And it's response to the, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I think Matthew, who says, attributes to Jesus saying, I did not come to change the law,
to fulfill it.
And this book partly responds to, you know, a challenge in that statement. It says, well, how far does that go, or can I really buy that, or when is Jesus really going beyond that description?
Would Jewish Reconstructionists make the same claim? We don't come to change the law, but to make it meaningful?
Reconstructionism comes from a point of view of, we really want to try to we don't want to try to change the law. We want to try to work with it and make it meaningful. Mm-hmm.
And the quickie description, some of you have already heard this, of the Reconstructionist movement. Set Orthodoxy aside for a moment and look at the three branches of Progressive Judaism. You have Conservative, Reconstructionist, and Reform. Conservative really ultimately feels bound by halakha. The Reform movement, when it sees a law that doesn't seem to work, has been fairly quick to say, okay, well, we just won't do that anymore. The Reconstructionist movement tries more conscientiously to engage the legality, the rules, and say, do we want to continue with this? Is there a way of refashioning this to make it make sense to us so that we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater? And the catchphrase of the Reconstructionist movement is, the tradition has a voice, but not a veto. And so that the conservatives would say, well, no, the past, the tradition has veto power. And the Reform movement would say, we don't have to listen to that if it doesn't make sense to us. And the Reconstructionist movement says, we have to listen, but then we have to make our own decisions. That's the quickie. And so the rest of what we have here is really this question of how do you observe the Sabbath? How do you deal with the tug of other demands on your lives? How do you make it meaningful? How have you constructed or reconstructed it to make sense? I don't think any of you have to deal with Sunday morning soccer practice.
Hockey.
Oh, hockey? Okay, well, there you go. Okay, so what do you do with hockey?
We said no to hockey.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a real tough, thing in hockey-loving towns to tell your child that that's not an activity that you can do.
This brings up for me that I think another thread we haven't really talked about, and that's the negative associations with observing Shabbat that I think are common for Jews and Christians. I mean, there's a lot of old Christian tradition of these rigorous, you just don't do anything, there'd be any fun at all, and there's a lot of that in Judaism in the past as well, and so. And I think many of us come to this with a concern that the last thing we want to do is turn our children away from our faith by making it into something that's all it is about is loss, of loss of hockey, loss of whatever. And trying to walk that tightrope is not easy. And I'm sure that you make missteps all the time. I know I do. And and perhaps more of them on the side of letting go of tradition in favor of not making it so, as I look back and, midway through most of them.
It just seems to me that either a youngster or an oldster doing his regular work during the week, either in the office or in the school or whatever, that soccer or hockey or whatever is a form of rest. And that person is observing.
I agree with that. I don't have any trouble with seeing soccer as a violation. What it does, though, is keeps you from getting the services. And that's I think that's what you're saying about hockey, too. That not that you didn't want them to do hockey on Sunday. It was that it was during church. Is that right? Yeah. And so, but I agree that, I don't have any problem at all with playing soccer on Shabbat.
Terry?
We would observe by attendance at services, and any team that was a choice of either lay around and just kind of play through the day, or do all the household chores and more.
Yeah.
And in Oregon and Washington, it's often portrayed on maps of percentage of faith believers as having a very low percentage. So we found ourselves challenged on Sunday mornings. Interestingly, we had people saying, well, our daughter's going to have her birthday party this morning. Can your daughter come? Mm-hmm. And, to a kid, a birthday party is a big deal. But it was right up against the church participation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're a native Washingtonian, right?
And isn't this interesting? Because from a Jewish stereotype point of view, we just figure you never have to deal with this. And here immediately I hear all these stories of what it is.
I think these days, this observing the Sabbath for most Christians is, if they observe it, is to go to church, mm-hmm. and that is a kind of Sabbath. But in terms of rest, I don't know how many of us ever actually rest at any time, certainly not on the Sabbath. So the minute church is over, you're off doing, especially if it's a nice day, you're off doing things.
Yeah, we have a church softball league on Sunday.
Yeah, now that is recreation, and I don't mean that, but I'm thinking, getting stuff done.
Right, all that stuff.
And there's also, there's going to the mall. I know Dorothy's chapter in the Practicing Our Faith, book is really talks about sort of the pernicious effect of doing our shopping, making and by extension, requiring that others are going to have to work at the stores.
And this really gets into the theme, another theme we didn't talk about of Shabbat, but sort of the social justice theme. I mean, you know, Shabbat's part of it's just one part of a bunch of cycles of rest that are structured in the Hebrew Bible. You know, the every seventh year, letting the lands lie fallow, and the Jubilee, like we're going to replicate here next week. And those,
the Hebrew scriptures say your animals also need to rest.
Right. And
your slaves, your
servants, your slaves, everybody and every creature rests.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Rests for Shabbat. So that there are some real, and then with the years,
the
land needs a rest. There are times when debts are to be forgiven,
right.
When prisoners are to be set free. You know, so there's a lot of there's redistribution of land. I mean, there's fairly Marxist stuff in there about what to do about this. So there are really some big issues of how rest plays into social justice.
It's a creation-friendly idea.
Mm-hmm. And Arthur Waskow actually makes a really big point about the notion that domination and control over others is a kind of work. And it's something that we really need to break from, which I think really fits in with the stuff that Dorothy talks about, of letting other people have the day off.
That's right.
By the way we make our choices.
Terry?
I actually have two comments. One is about not working on Jubilee. If you could take that to the supervisors at this village, that'd be
It was interesting at the staff meeting as they described what they had planned for Jubilee. It just didn't sound to me like it fit at all. They had sign-up sheets for all kinds of extra work. lists, right.
But separately, I wanted to... we often talk about systemic problems with observance or processes. And in 73, when there was the oil crisis, in Germany, I know that they just banned all automobile traffic every Sunday. And it worked. You could walk on the Autobahn. Hmm. And I often thought that if we said in America, this one day you cannot use the roads for your personal vehicle, people go ballistic because economically, socially, every way, we're tied into it. So it's a systemic thing. So how can I create in my society, my small community, a system that will support me? Because I think systemically, the system doesn't.
Yeah.
In professions or employment, it's now how much can you do? And it's, I'm hearing now up here, having been here for a while, I never heard it
yourself.
But I guess it's catching on is the expression 7/24. You're on 7 days a week and 24 hours a week.
Yeah.
Just to bring you into the modern world, it's 24/7. These are I think really big issues because it was an amazing experience to be in Israel. I mean, you don't even have to think about observing Shabbat. I mean, you haven't got any choice.
It shuts down.
The entire place.
Yeah.
So Friday afternoon, everything is starting to close down. There's people, flowers for sale. Flowers for the table are a big Shabbat tradition. Everybody's carrying flowers everywhere you go. It's like huge out in front of the supermarket. Just, you know, the entire sidewalk covered with, you know, those jugs with that bouquets stuck in them like you see at the florist. And everything changes. You make all your plans around the fact the buses are going to stop running. Everything's going to stop. Parts of Jerusalem, you're dangerous to drive in on Shabbat because of getting rocks thrown at your car and stuff like that by through some of the Orthodox sections. So, you know, it really shuts down.
Yeah. Isn't it incredibly peaceful? I lived in Berlin 25 years ago when stores still closed at noon on Saturday and didn't open up till Monday morning.
Wow.
And at noon on Saturday, the city would just, there would be a peace and a quiet.
Yeah.
Peace is exactly the word. There's the descent of peace.
Yes, you could
peace
actually feel it. It was palpable. And it would go like that. And it would just, I mean, it would be inconvenient, sometimes.
Yeah.
But the peace was just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it does make it a lot easier when it's systemic, as you say.
Yeah.
A whole lot easier.
In Israel, is there still support for that among the non-practicing citizens in that country for shutting down? And
yeah.
I know that the Spanish siesta is closing down.
Evolving,
the city,
yeah.
And they're, yeah. You know, they're having trouble bucking the tide with that. How about in Israel?
They seem to be doing it in Israel. They still take pretty long lunches in Israel too. We discovered.
So yeah, it's. I mean, the level of workaholism is just nothing, you know, compared to here. It's.
And so but it's, again, you're talking about a lot of people working a six, 5.5 day week. Mm-hmm. So it's really, you know, Sunday morning through Friday noon is their work week. So they're ready for Shabbat.
Yeah, and schools structure that way too, on the 6 day, you know, 5.5 day schedule, and all. I actually talked with a couple of Christians in Israel who were describing basically that they're in Fat City, you know, because they've got all of Shabbat, you know, and then well into Sunday before they get back to doing anything, so that it's you know, they actually do Shabbat in a traditional sense, that the last day of the week, Shabbat, and then have the further refreshment of their whole sub services on Sunday morning. So it's a particularly restful stretch. And it's a, and to me, it's a really, it's an interesting, I mean, it seems to really fit the Christian model to do that, you know, that kind of the revisiting resurrection and all of that after Shabbat, which is just the way it happened, you know. So it was very intriguing to hear about it, something I'd never thought of before.
Can you give an example back to the conflict orientation? In the congregation where I attend, I live in an agricultural community, so work is in the very traditional biblical sense, plowing, harvesting, all that sort of stuff. And, although more and more of the newer members are white collar workers. It used to be that we'd get together on one day of the week, Saturday for us, didn't matter, to do the lawn mowing and weed and the gardens and things like that. People would volunteer to do that. That's not happening anymore because people are too busy with those soccer games and the kids and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We were talking about that issue. One of the younger members says, how about if we have a little shorter service on Sunday morning, have a little potluck, and then we'll stay and do the gardens? Because, number one, for us, we've already dedicated that morning as family time. Or we've taken it away from our family.
Away, yeah, away. You
know,
isn't that,
and that's a big issue for people with young kids today. You
yeah,
know?
But isn't that a great, I mean, that's a really a great description,
yeah,
you know?
Taking it away,
away from our family. It's,
and number two, boy, weed and garden doesn't work for us. I mean, work for us is balancing the and the books.
Right.
And so we set this thing up. We were going to do this kind of short serviceness. And I got the owners in my office the next day. I'm a pastor. Boom. You will not be working on Sunday afternoon, you know? And these people want to weed their gardens at home, we don't control that, but we will not as a church give witness to work here. And I said, weeding gardens does not work for them. Do you understand that? Doesn't matter, but that's another way.
It's an interesting reconstructing.
Yeah. Younger members are saying, this makes sense.
Yeah,
it's Sabbath honoring in a way for us.
Yeah. Right.
And you could, and yet you could make an argument that if they thought more deeply about that, is it really Sabbath honoring, or is it is it just a way to, you know, cram a little bit more in a creative, you know, way, as opposed to truly taking a day of rest? And, so and who knows what the answer is? I don't know.
Right. So. Our time is drawing to an end, and remarkable to me, because we probably could keep talking for a long time. But what we wanted to do was what we've done in the last few sessions, which is to end with some singing. And we have a song, not too many words, and not a very complex tune, that we ought to be able to do. Ma yafeh hayom, Shabbat shalom. Ma yafeh hayom means how beautiful the day. Shabbat Shalom, of course, is both a greeting and a sense of the peace of the Sabbath. And it goes like this. Ma yafeh hayom, Shabbat Shalom. Ma yafeh hayom, Shabbat Shalom. And it continues. Shabbat, Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat, Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat, Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat, Shalom. Let's try it. Maya Sehayom. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. That was typically beautiful for Holden, and I want to thank you all for coming. I want to wish you the best in your struggles and in meeting the challenge of keeping the Sabbath in your way and in your time, and in this world of eternal time that we sometimes have a glimmer of our place in, and to say a few hours early to all of you, Shabbat Shalom.